Good evening and welcome to the Mutual Fund Observer conference call with John Park and Greg Jackson of Oakseed Opportunity. All participants will be in a listen-only mode. Should you need assistance, please signal a conference specialist by pressing the star key followed by zero. After today's presentation, there'll be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, you may press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. To withdraw your question, please press star and then two. Please note this event is being recorded. And I would now like to turn the conference over to David Snowball. Please go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Emily. Hi, everyone. And welcome to our latest conversation, this one with Greg Jackson and John Park, managers of the Oakseed Opportunity Fund. As always, I'll begin with a statement of the obvious, that it's really hard to find a fund manager who can consistently outperform a passive benchmark. There was a really very good essay posted at Morningstar on the 13th of this month called A Measure of Active Management, in which the nice folks from Touchstone Investments actually sort of walked through the research literature that helped us understand why it is that large funds so consistently do poorly, and that raises the annoying observation that more and more money is flowing into less and less active funds. The mission that the Observer has is to try to move beyond the universe of funds typically on Morningstar's radar to look at those funds that still have an opportunity to earn their keep. Distinctive funds, often risk-conscious, deeply passionate managers who have great records and who have the ability to serve their investors well. They are on whole, small, thoughtful, disciplined, and active funds. This is one of a series of calls designed to let our readers hear a reflection on a fund's genesis and strategy directly from its managers, and then to give you a chance to talk with those people in person. Our plan is to devote the first third of our hour together to an introduction to the fund, to the middle third, to my questions for John and Greg, and then we'll reserve the last chunk of the call for you folks to raise questions. Up until then, you'll be in a sort of muted mode, so you don't have to worry about making noise. Emily, partway through, will take a minute and let you know how you can queue up to ask a question of either John or Greg. With that being said, I'd like to thank the guys for joining us. It was very kind of you to spend part of your evening with us, and I thought I would invite Greg, if that's possible, to say a little bit about Oakseed, where it's coming from, and where you think it might be going.
Happy to do that, and I want to thank everybody for taking the time to spend some time with John and myself tonight. The Oakseed Opportunity Fund started in January of last year, January 1st to be exact. Actually, it started on December 31st of 2012. John and I have been prior managers, as David has highlighted. I used to manage the Oakmark Global Fund, and John Park used to manage the Acorn Select Fund and was co-manager of the Acorn Fund. I'll let John kind of give an overview of our firm and how we got started together, and then we can probably address where we see the fund going at that point. Do you want to take over, JP?
Yep. Thanks, and thanks also to David for providing us this opportunity. It has really been a pleasure to be associated with the Mutual Fund Observer, and we're grateful for all the participants in tonight's call. I thought we'd just spend a few minutes discussing our firm. I think it was discussed in the Mutual Fund Observer's discussion pages, where we really wanted to articulate how we're a bit different than most asset managers out there who are managing mutual funds, including the two organizations that we came from. Those were, as Greg mentioned, the Oakmark Funds and the Acorn Funds, and those are both based in Chicago. Greg and I met in Chicago back in 1992, and a lot of this is outlined in our letter dated June 30th to shareholders in the semi-annual report. But really, I wanted to emphasize, or perhaps even reemphasize, the perhaps unique attributes that Jackson Park Capital, as a fund's advisor, brings to the table, and possibly some competitive advantages that confers. We started out thinking about a firm and a fund and having a singular goal of the best possible returns that we could generate. And so when we look at that as our primary goal, kind of step backwards and say, how do we get from here to there? And in our careers, there have been various ways that we've approached that. But one of the ways that we thought could potentially maximize that potential goal would be to concentrate just on a single entity, not to have separate accounts where we would perhaps dilute our efforts and our time, where we would perhaps have to train additional employees, whether they be on the investment side or even on the operational side. So we made a very important decision early on that the Oakseed Fund would be the only client that Jackson Park Capital would have. And it also dovetailed nicely with some of the other objectives that we wanted, which was really to have complete alignment with all of our clients, our shareholders in the fund. We've both worked at organizations where we typically have separate accounts or we have more than one fund, in some cases a fund family. And that's not to denigrate that approach. That approach can work well and offers its own unique advantages. But we just always felt more comfortable if we were on the same page with all of our investors, in the sense that we had one vehicle where our own personal capital, as well as the capital of our friends, our families, our past investors, would co-align in such that we wouldn't dilute our efforts managing a different type of vehicle that might have different objectives. And I think that's important to mention, because it definitely curtails a asset management firm's potential in terms of assets under management. We certainly could have pursued outside separate accounts with additional capital coming in and make the firm more profitable, et cetera. And it was never really our goal, if you come back to what I said just a second earlier, to maximize profits as a firm. The goal really here was to just maximize the returns of the fund over a long period of time. So I do think that confers some competitive advantages. I think because we don't have to worry about most of the administrative things that most asset management firms are concerned with, it frees up a lot of our time to just focus on the investment side of the equation. The other aspect of the goal of getting the best possible returns was asking how we would do it in a risk-adjusted way. So there are plenty of fund strategies that can swing for the fences, and some have done remarkably well in adopting that approach. But I think Greg and I are inherently more conservative. We are putting so much of our own money and then our friends and our family's money into the fund, and will continue to do so, that we really wanted to be able to sleep well at night, not to worry about taking undue risk. And so our strategy is really to get the best possible risk-adjusted returns. And what that means is that we're going to hopefully be fairly stable, perhaps perform a lot better on downside protection strategies than upside. We may not necessarily be at the top of the charts when markets are swiftly ascending. And we're okay with that. We just want to make sure that that's transparent and all our fellow investors are okay with that, because that's the strategy that we feel is the best way to accomplish what our goals are. Again, the best risk-adjusted returns. Having said that, we also know, having been doing this for a while, that to maximize long-term returns, you have to take on risk when you see the opportunity where you can get paid more than fairly for taking on that type of risk. There are various scenarios, but a recent example would be in 2008, when any company that had excess debt on its balance sheet was really drubbed during that 12 to 18 month period from 2008 to 2009. And there were some great opportunities where we looked at several different types of companies and industries where cash flow, despite an economic recession, was really not impacted or not impacted heavily, such that they could meet debt service obligations. But the way the stocks were priced, it looked like Wall Street was expecting them to file bankruptcy. And that's just one example of many that we've seen, given market volatility over multi-cycles. And so we know that when those opportunities present themselves, yes, you are inherently going into riskier assets because, in my example, they had a lot of debt on the balance sheet. But when you look at potentially the risk and the reward and how much upside you could potentially get, you know that the odds are greatly in your favor, and we have to take those investments. So that is really sort of the heart of what we're trying to do. And by being a fund that can go into many different areas, international markets, large cap, small cap, mid cap, we think that we can best accomplish our goals because opportunities present themselves in all different corners of the market in any given moment of time. It's usually the case that small caps and large caps typically under or outperform each other. So on relative valuation basis, we will look at what is the most relatively attractive asset category. And we tilt more towards the relatively undervalued asset category than all others. And those things go in cycles. So currently, we saw more values in the large cap space at the beginning of this year. We think that's still true today. But in the future, there could be an instance where small caps or mid caps look much more attractive. And so that's our approach. We want to take all the different experiences that we have had as professional money managers, having specialized in industries and different market capitalization categories, large, medium, small, international versus domestic, and really just go where we find the best opportunities, again, keeping in mind that risk-adjusted return. I think that's pretty much what I wanted to cover. Greg, if you have anything to add.
No, I don't have anything to add to that other than the fund is designed to be all cap and all world, as John outlined. We have the ability to short if we find something that is interesting from a short standpoint. We have the ability to short indices. We have the ability to use options when necessary. We can write covered calls. We can write put options. So this fund is the most flexible vehicle that we've ever run in our historical past. And we designed it that way so that we could take advantage of all of the things we've learned over our 22 years of managing money. That's the only thing I would add, JP.
And there's a little housekeeping note. We wanted to, I know that we've gotten some inbound inquiries through our website, emails, different advisors that we know about the Oakseed Opportunity Funds availability on the Fidelity Funds Network and NFS. Greg, you've been working on it. Do you want to give an update on that?
Absolutely. We're pleased to announce that as of today, we've signed the final paperwork with Fidelity. The fund should be available in the next 3 to 10 days is what they told us this morning. So look for that over the next 2 weeks.
We will post that on the website when it's available.
Great. Well, thank you. Talking about the sort of platforms, raises a couple other questions that folks had been curious about. One was the almost breathtaking reduction in the cost of getting into the institutional shares. You originally had $1 million minimum, and now, at least for direct purchase, it's down to $10,000. What led you to that?
Initially, when we were setting up the fund, we thought, this is Greg speaking, by the way, we thought it was necessary that we had that big differential. Our investor class shares had a $2,500 minimum, even lower on an IRA. And we found out later that you don't need that big of a difference to have institutional class shares. So we lowered it as low as we possibly could to allow people. It's a lower fee structure for people, and so we wanted to make that available to as many people as possible.
Oh, okay. And so when you said,
I might add, David, is John, if I could, I think you had profiled us back in May and had said something to the effect that we didn't enjoy marketing. And I think the decision to initially begin with $1 million for our institutional class shows that we really didn't know anything about marketing. We had been out of the mutual fund industry for a while, didn't have a good handle. We didn't have the institutional class and investor class structures when we were at our mutual funds in the past. And so really it comes down to whether or not individual investors want to pay the additional 25 basis points on the investor class shares for the 12b1 and not pay a transaction fee with most custodians like Charles Schwab. Or they could elect to pay a transaction fee and then forego the 12b1 on an annual basis. And we wanted to make that more of the investment-making decision rather than this big differential of capital on the initial investment.
Oh,
now,
okay.
Some custodians have the right, as per their contracts with us and others, to set a higher minimum. So Charles Schwab, as an example, still requires $100,000, which is quite a bit lower than $1 million, but not as low as our $10,000 that we were trying to get in place.
And that's just because Schwab is sort of whimsical in setting these things, or
Capricious, yes, that's right.
Yeah, that would be my early guess. Cool. And so FIDO within 3 to 10 days, and then on the institutional front, it is pretty much up to the individual platform, whether or not they're going to reduce the minimum and by how far. You'd talked a little bit about the fact that you tried to look for stocks that were relatively attractively valued as you move between domestic and international, or large and small. Could you talk a little bit about what it means to be relatively attractive? Like, what are you looking for?
Why don't you take that one, JP?
Yep. So this is John Park. And the relative attractiveness is a starting point. So Greg and I, by our natures, are contrarian more than, say, momentum, if that could be called the opposite of contrarian. So a good place to fish is usually the asset class that has underperformed in recent history. So when we look at different investment universes, it seems to be more fertile to go to the asset category that has underperformed over the past 3 or 4 or 5 years. That could not only be in terms of market capitalization size, but it could also be, in many cases is, industry. There are periods when the cable industry in the mid-90s was severely out of favor. There were periods in my career, 20-plus years of doing this, 3 different times where the biotechnology industry was severely out of favor, and all those companies were starved for capital. And there you had more small caps being out of favor in a particular industry. The cable stocks were more large cap being out of favor. So that's really what we try to do. We look at different areas that have underperformed. You know, this year has been really hard to identify any industry or market capitalization that has underperformed. But REITs, REITs, as an example, real estate investment trusts, have not kept up as much. And in many cases, they're pretty flat on a year-to-date performance basis. So just throwing out an example, that's one area that Greg and I have recently spent some time looking at.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so you start with the question about roughly who's been kind of sucking egg lately. And then as you approach a REIT, what do you do? How do you think about whether a particular REIT is going to be attractive enough for your purposes?
Let me use an example that we've actually disclosed on our fact sheet. We bought Chamber Street Properties in the third quarter, and we made it a 4% position in the fund. And there's a bunch of ways to value REITs, and sometimes REITs get extremely overvalued because people pay too much for the dividend yield. People are after the yield, and they forget about the PE or the free funds flow that you value a REIT on, which would basically be equivalent to the net income that would be attributable to a normal company. And remember, REITs don't pay any taxes at the corporate level because they pay out 90% of their earnings to the shareholders. And so sometimes they get higher PEs because of that. In the case of Chamber Street, we were targeting a minimum of a 6% yield, and it just so happened the company came public in the second quarter, and then their share price took a major hit. It came public at 10, and then went down to hit a low of $7.16 a share. We were lucky enough to start buying the stock at about $7.40 a share. At that price, it was yielding over 7%, and at that price also it was trading at 11 times what would be compared to a PE ratio, so about 11 times PE. And for a REIT, that's extremely cheap. This is a very unique company. It's a triple net lease business. Their largest customer is Amazon, so it's a very stable revenue base. Amazon makes up about 7% of the entire real estate base. But we were getting over a 7% yield at about 11 times earnings. That to us was extremely attractive, because we think the growth will be, at least in the earnings or the free funds analysis, will be probably high single digit to low double digit. So that's an attractive REIT to us. In the fourth quarter, since the quarter end, we've purchased another REIT. It's growing much more quickly than Chamber Street. We haven't disclosed that one, so I won't mention the name.
Right.
It yields about 4%, but it's growing its earnings, if you will, at about a 17 to 20% clip. And it's trading at about 16 to 17 times earnings. So again, on a PEG basis, or price to earnings to growth rate, it was about a 1-to-1. And so that's an attractive investment for us.
Cool. One of the my readers had asked if you could talk a little bit about one of your larger positions, Express Scripts, and why you thought, because they noted you've been adding to the position, why you thought why you thought that was attractively valued.
JP, do you want to take that since I answered the REIT question?
Well, sure. Express Scripts is the largest pharmacy benefit manager, and these folks are basically an intermediary between, say, corporate health plans and drug companies, and they lower costs by sort of having volume purchasing power because they amalgamate all their corporate clients, so they can negotiate better drug prices from the pharmaceutical companies and then pass that on, but still make their sort of spread on top of that. We liked Express Scripts particularly because the acquisition of Medco. Medco was the pharmacy benefit manager that, 20-some years ago, Merck, the pharmaceutical company, bought. And then probably, 8 or 9 years ago, they spun it back out as a publicly traded company. And Express Scripts purchased Medco about almost 2 years ago now. Maybe it is about 2 years ago. And I think that acquisition was largely misunderstood. Opportunity early on and put together a lot of pro forma analyses that showed that the combined company would be a very, very competitive company in terms of its sort of economic moat, its sort of inordinate purchasing power vis-a-vis its competitors, CVS, and a smaller competitor. So we really like the fact that the stock was misunderstood and sold at a very cheap price if you looked at a pro forma combined company analysis. And so as a result, we added to the, we initially invested into it and then continued to add to it because we don't believe that the investment community has fully appreciated what we think is going to be a long-term growth and success story. The CEO, George Paz, is someone that is very highly regarded by us and others on Wall Street and has executed very, very well in his long tenure with the company. So we have a lot of faith that he and his team will continue to execute against plan and realize the benefits of the Medco acquisition and really sort of realize its vision of being the dominant player in this industry.
Sure.
And David, could I just add two quick things to that? Number one, historically, this company is traded for an average price-to-earnings ratio of about 19 times. It's trading at about 14 times 2013 numbers and about 12 times 2014 numbers. So it's trading at a very big discount to its historical trading pattern. And then number two, there's been a lot of confusion on Wall Street, and one of the reasons we think it's trading at such a low level is with the Obama healthcare plan, the Affordable Care Act, people are concerned, well, how will a PBM fit into that, a PBM being the pharmacy benefit manager? How will they fit into this new regime, if you will, and having these, you know, various pockets around the country? And we think they'll fit in very well because a PBM by itself, by its nature, lowers the cost of a prescription. And so they should be a net beneficiary to any one of these exchanges, that, and they should be signing up with them. But I think one of the things or cloud that's been over this company is how will the various exchanges affect them.
Okay. So when you talked about them being misunderstood, you think it's primarily, are they being particularly stigmatized, that is, more than CVS or more than their other competitors, or is it just the sector they're in is in turmoil because the administration is confusing people?
I think Express Scripts themselves are being more directly impacted because they are the largest player in the industry by a factor of two, by the way.
Okay.
So I think the cloud, if there's a cloud over the industry, then the largest player themselves are going to probably be disproportionately hurt. We actually think, as John mentioned, the CEO is doing everything correctly. He's executing on this acquisition of Medco very, very well. There's some very complementary businesses that were brought in from Medco. And so we think right now Wall Street's really misunderstanding what's going on or more concerned about potential threats like affordable care that we just don't see being the major impact that maybe Wall Street does.
Oh, okay. And some of the folks had also noted that as you talk about being a sort of go-anywhere fund, that you folks have gone places most fund managers haven't, which is in the world of private capital or into venture capital. Is there any prospect of the fund investing beyond the kind of realm of sort of common stock or publicly traded equities?
No, this will be a public equity only fund. We do have the ability to go down the capital structure or up the capital structure, so we can invest in convertible debt, convertible stock, and so forth. But this fund will be a publicly listed only. We won't have privates or side pockets or anything like that as we had at our prior firms such as Blum Capital. But we will go all over the market cap range, as John mentioned before. We're completely agnostic as to the market cap of a company. It can be small. Our smallest company has $190 million market cap. Our largest company is Apple, so which is $400 billion or $385 billion. So we really don't care the market capitalization. We care about what the valuation is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, right now there's some attractive small little companies in biotech, and John has put a few of those into our portfolio because of his historical background mm-hmm. in that. And again, that would be considered historically somewhat of a venture investment.
Right. Okay. And have you worked with, in the days at Acorn or Oakmark, had you worked with shorting stocks or like, I know that you have a really good record in investing in stocks in a kind of long way. Have you done a lot with shorting, or have you done a lot with fixed income?
This is John Park. We really have spent the majority of our careers focused on the long side.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started in 1993 mm-hmm. at Wanger Asset Management, which was mm-hmm. the advisor to the Acorn Fund, we had a hedge fund that had started maybe a year before, maybe not even a year before, believe it or not, called the Flying Squirrel Fund, and managed by someone who today is a very good friend of mine and a very successful hedge fund manager in his own right, named Terry Hogan. And Terry and I worked on a lot of the healthcare shorts, as well as the longs. And what I discovered is that shorting is a really, really hard business.
Right.
I think it is, and Greg very similarly discovered the same thing. So we have had, I think, a paucity of truly convincing short ideas in our career.
Right.
It's really hard to find good long ideas, by the way, but it's even that much harder to find good short ideas. The notion of being hedged was something that we entertained in a different way. Shorts, in our view, should be offensive, not for hedging. Shorts
mm-hmm.
should be used because you're going to generate positive returns, positive alpha. And typically what that means is we're going to look at companies where we're doing due diligence on the long side. And this has happened several times in our careers where we think that we have a great short opportunity. It may be because we suspect fraud through very aggressive accounting. It may be because companies are touting how much EBITDA, which is a metric that we take large exception with. I'm happy to go through that in a different time. Yet their cash flow from operations is negative, which is the real cash of the business. Now, those are prime areas to explore a potential short opportunity. But it has to be right. You know, your odds are so hard on the short side for a lot of different reasons. But think about how we as a society are motivated with incentives to grow. If you're a salesperson at a company, you don't get a bonus because you come in with a sales quota less than the year before. You get a bonus because you're motivated with incentives to grow that. And it's true for every working citizen in the free world, probably. So that whole tide, you know, rising GDP, that happens over time. You're really fighting that macro trend, and that's a severe disadvantage. So to the extent that we do find something where we have high conviction, it's going to be a fraud, it's going to be a disaster because they're not really generating cash, but the rest of the world believes they are because
right.
they're touting some metric that doesn't really make sense, that's when we'll short a security.
Oh, okay. So, rarely.
David, I would add one thing to that. There is only one short in the portfolio right now, and that's the Russell 2000 index.
Yes.
If you look at the Russell 2000 today, it's trading at over 28 times earnings. It's up 30% year to date, so it's the short has actually hurt us short term.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the widest disparity between the Russell 2000 and the S&P 500 on recorded record. In fact, on the Barron's article that was recently put out on Sunday, they talked about small caps today. In fact, it was the Bank of America Merrill Lynch strategist mentioned that when you look at small caps of being this expensive dating back to 1979, the return in the subsequent 12 months has averaged a negative 1%, and they've trailed large cap stocks by 5 percentage points. So what we think today is small caps have had too big of a run.
Right.
And so we have about a 3.5% position short against the Russell 2000. What that does, it also dampens the volatility of the fund on down days.
Okay. Yeah, and the nice folks at the Luthold Group in Minneapolis spent, I think, 3 pages sort of banging their heads on the table on this very subject in their most recent perceptions for the professional investors that this is, you know, an inexplicably huge gap in performance and valuation between the small and large cap universe.
Exactly. The S&P 500 today has a P.E. ratio of about 15.5 versus 28 for the Russell. Historically, that gap has been 1 to 2 percentage points difference.
Right. Okay. Emily, I thought I would ask one more question and then invite folks who were listening in to raise questions if they had any. Would you go over with them how they could do that?
Sure. To ask a question, you may press star then 1 on your touchtone phone. If you're using a speakerphone, we do ask that you please pick up your hands up before pressing the keys. And to withdraw your question, please press star and then 2. Once again, it's star then 1 to ask a question.
Great. Thank you, ma'am. And so I'll ask the guys one more question, maybe 2, and then we'll check back with Emily to see if you folks would like to talk with John or Greg. As we look at the portfolio then, you do have this short on the Russell 2000. Last I checked, you were in the 15, 16, 17% range in cash, all of which has to kind of impact the kind of year-to-date performance of the fund. You've got really strong absolute returns and really weak relative relative ones, and I was wondering how you were thinking about 2013 and what it says either about the fund or the market.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that. Last week I called John and we were chatting on the phone, and I said, if I told you in September of last year, or October of last year when we were setting up the fund, if in our first year the fund would be up 22%, what would you say? And John's response said that would be phenomenal, except that the S&P 500 is up 26%.
Right.
So on a relative basis, you know, we don't like that at all. I can tell you that in hindsight, clearly holding too much cash this year and being short for much of the year, at least on the Russell 2000, has definitely impacted the fund. But as John mentioned in his previous comments or the first of the phone call, on a risk-adjusted basis, we really like the portfolio. We can sleep at night. If anything tomorrow happens, heaven forbid another 9/11 or something like that happens, this is a sleep-at-night portfolio. Now, the small hedge that we have on right now wouldn't protect the entire portfolio, but it would act like a parachute in a falling market.
Mm-hmm.
And that just allows John and I to sleep at night. As John also referenced, in up years like this, where the market is only going one direction, we're going to typically trail. In down markets, we tend to do very well. As a data point, and you can go back and people can look at this, the Oakmark Global Fund in 2002, when the market was down 18%, the Oakmark Global Fund was down 1.8%. So John and I historically have protected the downside of our fund's investors. And we think if you start with a defensive mindset first, the offense will help take care of itself.
Okay. Cool. And as you think about both Oakmark Global and Acorn, do you think of this fund as looking more like one or the other of them? Or is it kind of a creature of its own?
John, you want to take that one?
I'd be glad to. Again, this is John Park. We want the fund intentionally to look like a fund that employs strategies that both of us, both individually and jointly, employed throughout our careers. And the reason for that is we had funds that had certain mandates. The Oakmark Global Fund was perhaps the most flexible of all the various funds that we and firms that we've been affiliated with. And that really resonated with both myself and Greg. When I was the manager of the Acorn Select Fund, it was a mid-cap fund. Now, we had some small caps and we had some large caps, and that was because I really wanted to own those. But, you know, by fund charter, we had to invest mainly in a pretty a generally fuzzily defined mid-cap sector. And what that meant was that in the Acorn Fund, where I was still not only the co-portfolio manager, but also still the biotech and healthcare analyst and some other industries, I couldn't put all these little tiny interesting biotech companies into the Acorn Select Fund. I had a gentleman ask me not that long ago, in your 20-plus year career, what was the best industry from a return perspective you ever invested in? And I had to think about it for a bit, and I said, believe it or not, it was the biotech industry. It's a feast and famine industry. There are nuclear winters where capital is starved, and companies in the public space trade below their cash balances, which I've always thought is sort of an arbitrage, because in the private equity world, biotech companies don't trade below their cash balances,
right,
no matter how much they're shunned. So that's the inefficiency of the public markets that we love. And because certain funds, including Acorn Select Fund, couldn't invest in those types of securities, it was locked out from it. And I really wanted, and Greg really wanted, to have a vehicle that could take that aspect of my career and another aspect of Greg's career and really pursue that wholeheartedly when that opportunity presents itself. Greg mentioned that we had a few biotechs. This year, the biotechnology industry has been on fire, and there's been a ton of IPOs and a lot of capital raised. You really don't want to go whole hog in an environment like that. In fact, we've taken more chips off the table than anything. But there will be a period where people hate it again, capital will not flow into the industry, and we're going to be ready. And so that is something I couldn't do in Acorn Select that we can do with the Oak Seed Opportunity Fund, and we will do.
Oh, cool. Thank you. Emily, I didn't know if there were folks who had questions.
Yes. The question that came in is from Timothy Garr. Please go ahead.
Okay. Since this basically is a stock – hey, how are you guys doing? Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
You're a little bit garbled, but I think we can make it out.
Okay, this is a stock picker's fund, and we're going on your stock picking ability. When you guys were setting up this fund, why did you set it up with the SEC as a diversified fund instead of a non-diversified fund? A non-diversified fund, basically, you can be rewarded with your stock picking ability more than a diversified fund.
You can. The difference being, there's a 25% basket for a diversified fund. There's a 50% basket for a non-diversified fund, and that basket is for your over 5% positions. And
right,
so,
right,
you know, we can be pretty concentrated. You know, generally, you only find one or two really good ideas that you want to have tremendous capital behind. I'm talking 5 to 10% of your assets in that particular stock. And a diversified fund still gives us that opportunity, because you could have two positions that are 10% each, and it still is within the 25% basket. You're right, if we wanted to have 10 positions that were over 5, or you really couldn't do that. You could have 8 positions over 5% and still be in a non-diversified sense. But we think the diversified sense is plenty for us from a diversification standpoint and a concentration standpoint.
Okay, if I could add to that as well, I just talked a minute ago about the biotechnology industry. And while we may have high conviction in any particular company and its security, because it's such a, what I call, long duration equity, you know, you're not getting any cash flow potentially ever, we tend to diversify in that particular sector. So there could be a period where we actually have more securities than we otherwise normally would own because of the opportunity. The biotech industry, again, goes through one of these down cycles. We pick up 10 to 15, maybe even 20, with small positions each, just like a venture capitalist portfolio. And the idea is that if we hold them for 10 to 15 years, one or two of those companies will be a success. And you have to get the types of returns, 10, 20, 30 times your money on those one or two ideas, because the other ones are probably going to go to zero. That's how we sleep well at night. We manage risk that way, by that type of approach. And so having the non-diversified format will allow us that flexibility.
The diversified format.
It just seems you have more flexibility in a non-diversified, where if there's two or three stocks that you just think, boy, we're just gung-ho on this, we're only going to have five stocks in the portfolio right now. I mean, you can do that with a non-diversified fund, where the diversified fund, you just can't do it. How many equity holdings are in the portfolio as of now?
There's 34 names as of today.
And then what percent is in the top 10?
Oh, that's a good question. It's probably
43%.
There you go.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, Tim.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Em. Other folks on the line?
As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then one at this time.
Okay. And while we wait to see if other folks join in, I was wondering if you are holding 16% in cash, what that tells us, is there a concern about the height of the market where you think, gee, sure would be nice to have some cash soon, or is it just that there aren't enough good biotech ideas, or...
It's twofold. Number one is we've received a lot of cash, and we appreciate that, the new inflows coming into the fund.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is so many of our companies have gone up so far and so fast, we've kind of slowed down adding to them. We still like them, but not enough to add to them as they've gone up. So you've seen some of the position sizes come down as a percentage of the assets. Halliburton would be a great example. You know, we bought the stock at about 37 to 39. It's today 55 or 54, 35 today. We just are not chasing it. It's a company we still like longer term, would love to add to it if it pulled back into the 40s, but it's not something we're adding to today. John and I are very comfortable, by the way, running this fund fully invested. In fact, that would be our preference, is to have the fund fully invested. I think it's important for your readers to understand that fully invested to us means generally 95 to 96% invested. I personally always have held around 3 to 5 percentage points in cash because I always want to have the ability to buy a full position without selling something I already own. And 3 to 5% is a normal size position for us. So typically I've held that amount of cash in reserve. If something fell out of the sky tomorrow, I could turn around and buy it.
Okay. That works. Other folks, Emily?
Yes, the next one is from Frank Nobles. Please go ahead.
Yes, how large do you think your fund can get to before we need to worry about that you won't be able to earn your fee?
You want to take that, JP?
Sure. We don't have an exact answer for that. We're only 88, 89 million today, so we're a long ways away. But our litmus test is if we ever felt like we had to hire additional staff, we would know that that's the time to shut the fund down in terms of new inflows, accepting new capital. And we don't want to use our time to invest in building out resources as a firm. It goes back to what I said in the opening remarks, which is our focus, the majority of our time has to be spent on the investment process, the two of us, not on running the firm. So could that be $1 billion? Could it be $5 billion? Potentially, but you know, I think that we both like the go-anywhere opportunity set that we currently have today. When you start getting more than $5 billion, some of these smaller companies mean less and less, and that means that you've got to put together potentially a 60, 70, 80 stock portfolio. That also means that you've got to hire more people. So somewhere in that 1 to 5 billion range, we're just not sure exactly. It'll sort of come to us when it happens. But we're a long way from there, and we think we've got a lot of capacity between, you know, the $88, $89 million today and that period.
And I think, John, I'll just add one thing. John mentioned something at the start of the call. I think the most important thing is we're not trying to make our living off the management fee of this fund.
Right.
We want to make our returns speak for themselves. Our money invested in the fund will drive our livelihoods. So we're not in it for the fees. So whether it's $1 billion, $3 billion, $5 billion, we're not looking at it from, okay, how much from a fee standpoint can we gather? It's where can we get the best returns? And if it's $1 billion, we'll shut it down at $1 billion. If it's $3 billion, we'll do it at $3 billion. I think we'll know when it gets there. I know historically, John and I have both run funds that were over $2 billion in size,
mm-hmm.
and we still generated decent returns. So
right.
That's kind of our litmus test of, you know, what have we done in the past, and can we continue to do that in the future? So I agree with John. It's somewhere between 1 and 5 today.
Right. And so your thought would be, if you've got these two constraints, you'd like to be able to invest in, if not micro caps, pretty small companies, and you'd like to maintain a pretty compact portfolio. You could do that at $3 billion, just kind of to pick your mid-range.
That's right.
You could still pull that off.
Yep.
Okay, cool. Emily, other folks?
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star and then one.
Great. One of the folks who'd written in noted that you had your time with Bloom Capital, and they were wondering what you think that might have contributed to the work that you're doing today.
I think the biggest thing that John and I gained by working from a private equity standpoint, Bloom Capital had the ability, just for those who don't know the firm, to invest 100% of their assets in the public market or 100% in the private market. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to see both sides of the coin, if you will. John and I have served on public boards, three different boards each. We've served on private boards, so we know how a boardroom dynamic works. We also know how hard it is to get things done, being a more activist investor. There are other people out there like a Carl Icahn who are very successful at it. John and I realize being in that world, we don't have the sharp elbows that a Carl Icahn has, and nor do we want to have the sharp elbows. We value our personalities, we value friends, and you know that's just not the lifestyle that he and I want to lead. So a good friend of mine mentioned to me one time, if he has to give a management team advice, he's made a mistake. And I think John and I have learned that it's when you're in a turnaround situation, turnarounds are very hard to turn most of the time.
And so you'd rather not be a management consultant.
Yeah, this is John Park. I call it a Marxian philosophy, and I don't mean Karl Marx, I mean Groucho, because Groucho had this great line of any club that would have me as a member, I don't want to join. And if we actually have to get on a board to turn around a company from an operations perspective, to what Greg said earlier, it's most likely a mistake on our part. We should just sell the security and move on. And unfortunately, that's been our own sad experience being on several boards.
Great.
But we did learn a lot, David, to your point, of how boardrooms work, how the other side, you know, investors are always looking at the company saying, you ought to do X, Y, and Z with your capital. We now know what it's like to be on the other side of that equation and being in the boardrooms, getting pressure from shareholders.
And that gives you a sense of how they're going to allocate capital, you think? Or
it just gives us a sense of what the dynamic is in a boardroom. And, you know, Warren Buffett used the term institutional imperative, that a lot of people, they don't make the right fiscal decisions sometimes in a boardroom. It is make an acquisition to grow the company or to get bigger, not necessarily grow per share value. And, you know, it's just an interesting dynamic. And that's why people like a Carl Icahn are needed, basically, because you want to fight against that institutional imperative. I just don't think I have sharp enough elbows to go in there and try to do the same thing.
Right.
We would much rather invest with a CEO who we feel aligned with in terms of their perspectives and decisions on capital allocation and capital structure.
So on whole, you'd rather be working with a really good management team whose product is being misunderstood rather than
correct. There's a wonderful book that was written recently. It's called The Outsiders. It was written by William Thorndike, and it profiles eight different CEOs. And what it does is a lot of people think about, hey, how do I run this business as effectively as possible? But what he highlights is a lot of the companies we invest in generate free cash flow. And over a 10-year period, that management team is going to redeploy basically the capital of the entire company over a 10-year period. And how they redeploy that capital is paramount to your rate of return. And so being aligned with very strong capital allocators is really a successful formula for investing. So the ideal investment for us would be to identify these outsider type CEOs and invest alongside of them. Again, you can overpay for any stock, so we want to be very careful about not overpaying. But if we can identify, and we think Express Scripts, by the way, fits that mold. We think George Paz is a similar type of CEO. If we could identify 20 names that fit that mold, that were at attractive valuations, you would see 20 names in the Oakseed Opportunity Fund, and we would just hang on to those companies.
Okay, cool. Emily, other folks?
Yes, the next question is from Andre Linde. Please go ahead.
Hi, Andre.
Okay, hi. I just wanted to ask, how much attention do we pay for tax efficiency of the fund and whether it's better to keep it in IRA or just in normal accounts?
We're extremely tax sensitive. We learned this when I was running the Oakmark Global Fund. somebody once told me that taxes are a tactical strategy, not an overall strategy. And so we think it's doing our shareholders a disservice if we don't harvest our taxable losses. John and I have a lot of our own money in the fund in a taxable account. And so we'll be very tax conscious. We go out of our way to harvest tax losses in our fund. So if something is down, we typically buy it ahead. I'll give you an example. The potash companies we owned, and then they both took a 20% hit, both Potash and Mosaic. John and I were very active. What we typically do is we'll buy about a third more of the position ahead of time, and then we'll wait 31 days and sell that position. And we'll do that two or three different times until we've harvested all of our high-cost position. What it does, it allows you to lower your average cost while also generating the tax loss. I can tell you today, with Mosaic and Potash, we have about a 20% gain in both of those companies, having already harvested all of our high-cost lots. So this fund will be very tax-conscious.
And does it mean that it will be mostly in the long-term capital gains, not income and not short-term?
Our goal is always long-term capital gains, if we can. This year, obviously, there have been a few things that have risen too far, too fast, and so there will be a very small short-term capital gain issued this year. It will be very, very small. Right now, we're finding a lot of higher dividend-paying companies, so our income portion of the fund could be a little higher than normal this year.
Thank you.
But you don't yet know kind of the magnitude of the capital gain payout or the year-end sort of income payout?
Yeah, we do. It's about 4 to 5 cents is the current estimate for the short-term capital gain.
Okay.
And as more assets come into the fund, obviously that will be diluted down even further.
Good. I was just actually trying to write that down with a bulky pen.
Yeah.
Cool. Em, we have time for one more question, maybe two. Are there folks who'd like to ask?
Yes, we do have one more. Tad Buchanan, please go ahead.
Hi, John, Greg. Thanks so much for your work here today. You guys are off to a great start, and I certainly appreciate the hard work you put into it. Wondering, given that valuations in the U.S. seem a little bit stressed, as exemplified perhaps by your cash position, wondering if you're seeing value internationally or in emerging markets.
Do you want to take that, John?
Sure. We find opportunities all over the world, and we have seen a few more, perhaps, most notably one of our larger positions, Teva Pharmaceuticals, which is an Israeli drug company. But I would say that's less about a geographic-specific instance and more about a company-specific instance. What that serves to illustrate nicely, I think, though, is that by opening up the opportunity set to beyond U.S. borders, we can find a company in Europe, which has also had a pretty good year in terms of stock market returns. But we can still find something like a Teva that has not participated for a variety of reasons and do our due diligence and analysis and come to the conclusion that it offers a very attractive risk-return profile. If we couldn't invest outside the United States, we wouldn't be able to pursue something like that.
I would just add that it's starting to blur from my time running the Oakmark Global Fund to today, where a company is domiciled is starting to really blur the type of business it is. You know, we own GlaxoSmithKline. It's a large pharmaceutical, worldwide large pharmaceutical. It just happens to be based in the United Kingdom. But it really doesn't matter. It could be based here in the United States. It just happens to be domiciled in the UK. So I think those lines are starting to kind of blur a little bit as far as where a company is actually domiciled. Teva is another great example, being based in Israel. I want to address specifically emerging markets. Emerging markets can get extremely out of favor. If you remember 1998 during the Russian flu crisis and the Asian flu crisis, if you will, those markets got down to unbelievably low levels. And I can say that our funds back then were very heavily invested in emerging markets. Today, I don't see the same extreme valuations today. I would much rather buy a larger company and let them maneuver the emerging markets, if you will, rather than so an Oracle, for example, or somebody, a large company like that. I'll let them do the investing, if you will, in the emerging markets vis-a-vis their company. But there is a time when emerging markets get extremely out of favor, And that's the time John and I would pounce.
Cool.
Terrific. Thank you.
Great. Did that work, Ted?
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, sir. Anyone else, Em?
Not at this time.
Well, cool. Then we're getting pretty close to the top of the hour, guys. And so we should begin sort of pulling things together. If you kind of thought about talking with folks who haven't joined the Oakseed Fund yet but are kind of contemplating it, if you had to kind of help them understand the thing they most need to know in order to figure out whether they're an investor who's going to be comfortable with you folks, do you have a sense of what's going to define the people who are going to be happiest with you?
I'll take my shot at it, and then I'll let John take his shot at it. I would say, in my opinion, it's that the managers are 100% aligned with the shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
We can't promise performance, but we can promise that our money will be dead alongside of you. Every penny that we have from an investable standpoint will be invested through the Oakseed Opportunity Fund. We will not own individual stocks at our firm and so forth. And as John mentioned in his opening remarks, we will not have other investment assets or other clients. Our single client will be the Oakseed Opportunity Fund. We have no plans to open another mutual fund. The Oakseed Opportunity Fund will be the fund that John and I run, and our money will be alongside of you. So we can promise that we'll do the best job we can, and our money will be with you. And so, to John's point, our interests are aligned from that standpoint. We can tell you that John and I are the most competitive people alive. We do not like underperforming the S&P 500, and so that eats at us every day. But I'll take a 22% absolute year, and then if I can protect my shareholders' money in a down year, from a peak to peak or trough to trough, John and I want to outperform over the market cycle, and that's where we expect to make our money, is more in the down markets. What would you add, John?
I agree 100% with everything you said, Greg. The only thing I have actually told various advisors who are more institutionally based than perhaps individuals, we are not going to be an easy fund to categorize, and so may not be appropriate, to answer your question directly, David,
mm-hmm.
for folks who want a large cap domestic equity allocation. Some folks have called in and said, well, that's kind of what you look like, and then I'll say, well, for a lot of our stocks, yes, but we do have some small caps. We have a REIT that's a smaller mid-cap stock in Chambers that Greg mentioned. And over time, that may dramatically change. We, because of, again, putting our own capital into the fund, we really want to be able to outperform in almost any environment and having the flexibility to go anywhere and not be constrained to a large cap domestic equity or, you know, mid cap or small cap global, whatever the various asset categories that people seek, particularly in the advisor world, means that it's not a good fit for everybody. And I just want to make sure that prospective investors understand that.
Great. Well, I'd like to thank both Greg and John, but also I'd like to thank all of those of you who've been listening in tonight. Wanted to let you know that a recording of this call and an audio profile of Oakseed will both be available at the Observer on December 1st. We'll do highlights and a link to an MP3 on the Observer's discussion board probably within the next 24 to 48 hours if you want to listen to it again or get a sense of what I thought went on. I also wanted to highlight our next call on December 9th. We're going to speak with Dave Sherman of Cohansic Asset Management about the River Park Strategic Income Fund, an odd and wonderful sibling to the odd and wonderful River Park Short-Term High Yield Fund. Dave's always a lot of fun to talk to, and I hope you all have a chance to kind of call in and speak with him in person as well. Guys, we were honored to have you tonight.
The honor's all ours.
I wanted to, on behalf of the folks, both those invested in your fund and those listening, to thank you for taking the time and to wish everyone a good evening. Bye now.
Thank you, everybody.
The conference is now concluded. Thank you for attending today's presentation. You may now disconnect.